This is a clash of maps. And in this story, the generals are rival cartographers, and their foot soldiers wield type and copper plates, industriously etching thousands of pages of text and images in their ever-expanding grand atlases. The prize? A new image of the world. A monopoly on geographical information. And with it, vast commercial wealth. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian, and welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. In Season 2, we continue to speak to people who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. No one is better placed to explain the mysteries and myths of what we call cartography, the science of map-making, than my guest today. Matthew Edney is Professor of Geography at the University of Southern Maine and OSHA Professor in the History of Cartography. He's written many books, including Co-Editing the History of Cartography, Volume 4, which is available for free online. In his most recent book, Cartography, The Ideal and Its History, Matthew argues that our assumptions about cartography are pretty flawed, and we need to give the subject a total rethink. Matthew, thank you for joining me on What's Your Map?
Thank you.
Could we start by asking, what's the map that you've brought in today?
Well, I've chosen one of the maps from the Sunderland collection, and it's the 1662 world map by Jan Blau, published in Amsterdam at the front of the huge Atlas Major, or the Great Atlas.
And what's its exact title, Matthew? Can you just give us a translation of that?
In English, it is the new and most accurate map of the entire world.
That's quite a claim. Just take us through what's going on here. We're in Holland, we're in Amsterdam in the mid-17th century.
So the map is literally setting the stage for a much larger work. As you go through the 16th century into the 17th century, as Europe is drawing more and more silver, especially some gold, but mostly silver from the New World, and it's driving this huge economic boom. There's this increasing practice of the wealthy to consume the world, to consume images of the world. One of the things that the Dutch do is they start making very large wall maps, but then they also start to create these atlases. They have customers who just want to show off. And so they want to buy bigger and more works. There's a comment that my Dutch colleague always loves citing about one of the consumers who says, yeah, I have the Atlas Major. I have it just piled up by my chair. And it's hideously expensive because all the maps through it are beautifully colored. I mean, very precisely. There's gold leaf throughout in highlights. You have every volume is bound in this incredibly expensive white leather with embossed gilt. The printing is just exquisite. The letterpress printing is crisp. These atlases, the paper is so thick, so incredibly gorgeous that when you turn the pages, they crackle. These are truly amazing works.
Can you just dive into the map and give us a sense of what we're looking at and its geography? The first thing, I guess, that will strike people is this is a twin hemisphere. So on the left, you have the Western Hemisphere, and on the right, the Eastern Hemisphere. Just give us a sense of the geographical detail on this map.
Sure. The left hemisphere, the left circle, is of the New World, in which South America is fairly well shown, is fully drawn. North America, less so. As you go to the west, you have California as an island, a very long, silly idea. And then as you go north of California, the continent just fades into nothing. But on the other hand, on the right circle, the Old World, you have a very full depiction of Africa, Europe, Asia, you know, the far northeast of Asia is a bit weird. And then down in the lower right corner, you have New Holland, what is now Australia.
Hollandia Nova.
Yes, named after the Dutch who discovered it in, what, 1628.
One thing, I guess, that cries out when you look at this map, it's the beauty of the colour, but then it's also, as we often find, Matthew, with these maps in the early modern period, that there's as much about what's happening outside the geographical frame of the depiction of the world with the iconography surrounding it.
This is actually the reason why I use this map in teaching, less about the geographical content and more about the iconography around it. Across the top of the map, you have two figures. One is drawn as an astronomer. He's staring at a celestial globe, all wrapped up nice and warm because it's cold observing at night. And on the other side, to the right, you have a less overly dressed geographer who is taking a measurement with a pair of dividers off a terrestrial globe, a globe of the Earth itself. And across the top, across everything, is this wonderful display of what look at first sight to be ancient gods.
Mm.
And then around these figures, you have each of these Roman gods is sitting on what looks like a little rainbow that's circling around Apollo, the sun god. So these are the planets which are orbiting around the sun. And then for the Earth doesn't have a rainbow. It has two clouds, two trails of clouds, like an airplane contrail, which are the two hemispheres as they're rotating around the sun. So the Earth is not geocentric in this sense. It's very much rotating around the Earth, but it is part of this larger cosmos.
Which is extraordinary, Matthew, isn't it? Because what you're seeing here, these figures you've described, on the left we really see the Greek tradition of Ptolemy and that geocentric universe that you've just described, which is now being literally eclipsed by the Copernican model of heliocentricity, so the fact that the Earth is not at the center of the universe, and that seems to depict the figure on the right. So this is, isn't it, a fascinating moment that Blau is one of the first mapmakers, if not the first mapmaker, to embed this idea of the break with the old geocentric tradition and embracing the new heliocentric tradition. But what about these figures at the bottom, Matthew, which I've always been so fascinated by? Can you explain what they are and what their significance on this map
is? Surely. So you've got these four sets of figures. Each one is sitting on a truck of some sort. Each of the trucks is being pulled by animals. So it's the seasons. We have spring. Everything is bursting into bloom and growing and newborn. Then you have summer with the height of the grain harvest. Then you have the fall and the harvest of everything else, including grapes and winemaking. Think Nouvelle Beaujolais. And then on the far right, you have winter, old man winter.
So again, it's cosmological again, isn't it? I mean, there's a sense in which it's the cycle of the seasons, and it's the heavens above with the Earth here being depicted. It's again a cosmology, I assume.
Exactly, because the seasons are known as being an effect of Earth-Sun relationships. So how the Sun and the Earth change in their interrelationships define the seasons. So across the top, you have the cosmos. And across the bottom, you have the effects of the cosmographical arrangement.
This is an extraordinary artifact. I mean, I was looking at the figures here for just this first edition of the Atlas Mayor, which is the atlas that has this map within it. I think the first edition has 11 volumes.
Yep.
It's 4,608 pages. And they are hand-painted, aren't they? So they're
exactly
engraved on copper. And the copper plate engraving techniques here are stunning. But then also, they just get bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, just the sheer volume of print coming off the press is extraordinary. But then everyone is hand-coloured. The scale of this product is really something else, is it not?
But it is. And it's a product of commercial competition between, on the one hand, Willem Janssen Blau and then his son, Jan Blau. On the other hand, the Hondius family and their successor, Geiger Jan Janssen. Johannes Jansonius.
So basically, it's a sort of map wall that starts developing in the early 17th century. We're in Amsterdam. We have dynasties, families who are now producing geographical texts, let's call them that, their maps, the atlases, which are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And there is suddenly this competitiveness. The Dutch East India Company is part of the story here with this massive expansion of international trade. The Dutch burghers are buying these incredible objects. They themselves are investing in the Dutch East India Company voyages, which is enriching the Republic, and more money is flowing back in. So they're sort of feeding off each other in a way, aren't they?
Well, exactly. So my favorite volume is the volume devoted to Scotland, not because the Dutch had a particular interest in Scotland, but because a Scottish antiquary found a collection of maps from the 16th century made by a guy called Timothy Pont, who also wrote extensive textual descriptions of all the different counties and parts of Scotland. And he sold them to the Blaus. And so the Blaus could make one more volume of this atlas to out-compete their rivals, the Hondius Janssen group. And so by having yet another volume that the Janssen guy just can't compete with, and they finally get up to 11 volumes. I think Janssen's largest atlas is only 8 volumes, maybe 9. but they're both trying to get the marketplace, their share of this largest, wealthiest economy at the time.
But Blau has a big advantage here, doesn't he? Because he becomes the official map maker for the Dutch East India Company, the VOC. And that does give him an edge, doesn't it? Because he's embedded in that corporate world, he's able to then draw on the information that's coming back in from the Dutch voyagers.
Exactly. There's, in a way, you have to understand that what we think of as cartography as a single enterprise is still very much discrete in different ways. And in particular, for the early modern period, there's a difference between marine mapping, charting on the one hand, and geographical mapping on the other. So Blau is actually one of the few individuals who occupies both sides of mapping. As the official chart maker for the East India Company, the Dutch East India Company, the VOC, he's responsible for collecting information as it's coming back from Dutch traders and their various fleets that are going around, especially out to Asia, and compiling that into new maps, keeping maps up to date, issuing maps to the VOC captains before they sail, receiving them back with any annotations. And then on the other hand, he's got this geographical business that's selling commercially, going out to the bigger public, and he's able to take all this new information that's coming in from the VOC in particular and incorporating it into his other maps.
What are we describing Blau as here, Matthew? I mean, he's a businessman, he's a geographer, he's a printer, he's part of the commercial world. I mean, what are we seeing here? These distinctions that we make today, I guess, aren't as clear-cut at this point in the mid-17th century, are they, about geographers, mapmakers, pilots, navigators, businessmen, printers, publishers?
You're absolutely right. This is confusion of roles. Partly is because the only name that really appears on these maps is Blaus. And so everybody says, oh, it's a map by Blau. But what it means really is that Blau is the publisher. He's like the producer in a Hollywood film, right? He's the guy who gets the money and then makes sure it's spent in the correct way to best effect. You don't waste too much on CGI or whatever. He ensures the creation of these huge works that are actually created by a small army of workmen and workwomen, for that matter. Some engravers were women. Hand colorists were mostly women, as far as we know. The copper plates are prepared by women as well as men. The printers are often women, but none of them are ever named, male or female. So it's this huge army that is there to do the work of the producer.
Before we continue, I just wanted to say that I'm so pleased you're able to join me on my journey into the world of maps, their stories, and the people who love them. If you're enjoying our podcast and don't want to miss a future episode, then please do consider subscribing and leaving a review when you finish listening. And if you think your friends and family might be missing out, why not ask them to give us a listen too? What happens to Blau and the Atlas, and how does that legacy endure? Indeed, does it?
Well, there's a map historian, among other things, in the Netherlands, Kees van Vliet, who wrote a book based on tax records from the 17th century, in which he describes the lives of the 100 wealthiest families in the Netherlands in the 17th century. And number one, the wealthiest, is William of Orange, the family of Orange, or the stadtholders of Amsterdam. And then, like 97, 98, most wealthiest individual was Jan Blau. And so, essentially, he gets out of the business. He retires, and the business fritters away. Different parts go to different people. And the whole grand enterprise effectively runs out of steam by the 1680s and is replaced by, in geographic mapping terms, by a whole new set of people who suddenly come to the fore, Frederick de Witt, the Vischers in particular, who start producing big atlases by modern standards, but nowhere near as big as the Atlas Mayor, and they're just maps. The Ortelian model that the Blaus developed along with the Janssen is maps with a large amount of text. And De Witt and Vischer, they just go just the maps.
So is it fair to say that Blau's legacy is actually, in an interesting way, it's about the birth of a market in maps and collecting maps, which of course is now a very large industry. You and I know this in terms of dealers who trade in maps. I mean, they're worth millions.
I would say it's the birth of mass consumption of maps as contemporary works, as works of contemporary knowledge. There's an absolute mania. It's a offshoot of bibliomania, that desire to collect as many books as possible. And in the late 17th, 18th century, it's this rise of a map mania, cartomania, to collect maps as documents about the world now. In the 19th century, you start to get, in the 1830s, 1840s, you start to get some collectors starting to collect maps because they're historical, because of what they say about the past. But it's only in the 20th century, after the First World War, when modernism is the ethos of the age, this desire to advance civilization through the active application of science. And so as part of this whole process, maps actually become a symbol of progress. Mm. People look at the old maps, and maps exactly like the 1662 by Blau, and they see the cuteness, how crude the outlines are in some parts of the map, and how decorative, how artistic it is. And they contrast them with maps of the modern age coming out of Britain and Germany and the United States in particular, which are really up-to-date and factual, but graphically, aesthetically sterile. And they see this history of cartography becomes this history of civilization, as moving from a crafty, craft-based, artistic sensibility to a more formal, scientific one.
You are effectively, you're the head of the project on the history of cartography. It's the Chicago History of Cartography. It's a defining multi-volume collection, massively influenced me. I mean, I pretty much got interested in mapping as a concept by reading this work in the, I guess, the late 1980s, early 1990s. Can you tell me a bit about your role there and what happened here? Because It's very much about these iconic figures, both of whom you were involved with, Brian Harley and David Woodward, who set up this project. And it really transformed how we think about this thing called cartography and its history. And you've now taken that to a different point of really critiquing this whole idea. But tell us a little bit first about your involvement and how you came to be involved in the Chicago History of Cartography project.
Well, the short story was that I had a teacher at high school who killed history for me, absolutely killed history for me. So I did my A-levels in math, physics, and geography. And I was going to be a land surveyor, and I ended up studying geography at University College London. But when I got to UCL, I discovered there's a number of people, Hugh Prince in particular, but Hugh Clout, Richard Dennis as well, who taught historical geography, which is a kind of geography that I just fell in love with because it's really an amazing field. Net result is I read this article my last year in London, book chapter by this historical geographer called Brian Harley, whose examples were all old maps. And his footnotes were pointing to a field that I had no idea about. There are these people who study old maps. And I thought, wow.
I just have to interrupt, because can I say that I can tell you almost the exact same story?
Mm.
I sat in a library at Sussex University in 1988, I think, and I read a piece by Brian Harley, and I said, that's for me.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating trajectory that Brian Harley, as you can say, you know, changed the whole study of map making as somebody, of course, was working with Ordnance Survey with a much more sort of, as it were, hands-on practical experience of mapping. And then he read various post-structuralist philosophical texts, which made him question the whole notion of mapping. And this, for so many of us, for you and me, and I think many of the people would say this, changed really our lives in a way, certainly our careers.
Oh, absolutely. So I read this thing, and I wrote to Brian, and my undergraduate tutor, Hugh Prince, said, if you're thinking about a PhD in the history of maps, well, think about America. And he mentioned David, and it turns out that David and Brian had already begun this huge project. Brian's line was, we need a four-volume history of how America was mapped. And David said, no, we need a four-volume history of cartography in 77.
Oh, really? I didn't know that that was the context. Okay.
They started exchanging outlines. In 81, David got the first grant from National Endowment for Humanities in the U.S. And in 83, he happened to have a new grant coming in with a money for a graduate student to work on the illustrations for Volume 1. And that was me.
Hmm.
So Volume 1 finally came in at 425,000 words, and it's got about 400 images. And every volume has grown bigger ever since.
Do you know what? I was just thinking as you said that, it's really like Blau's Atlas. It's just...
It just kept growing.
Joking aside, I mean, there is a sense in which this is an evolving project. So it's really changed the field, hasn't it? And even by the time those early volumes were coming out in the early 1980s, our understanding had become so sophisticated so quickly by the impact. I mean, they are my most prized books in my library. And you've, of course, carried on that tradition of publishing them and now online. And I wonder if you could say a bit about that, because it's rather like the evolution of printing itself, looking at Blau, going through manuscripts into print, and now we're going from print into online production. So where is the project now under your directorship?
Well, right now, I'm very pleased to say we're almost done with the very last volume to appear, which is actually volume 5 out of the 6, 19th century.
Mm.
So it should come out in July of 2027. Now, the arrangement I made with the press, University of Chicago Press, is that, you know, the books are designed to be printed. They're designed to be read in print. But they sell most of them within the first 3 years. And so I persuaded them to, after 3 years, put PDFs of each chapter online for free access. And to date, well over 5.5 million accesses and downloads of chapters and sections, which is not bad at all.
It's not bad. One of the projects that's developed in your work recently has been this very significant book that you wrote recently called Cartography, The Ideal and Its History. And it's had quite an impact. I think one of the reasons is because you take on board this question of cartography in the singular, and you say it's a flawed concept. And in your words, you say cartography deserves to die. I mean, I think that's a wonderful provocation, Matthew. So come on, you're going to need to explain this and unpack this a little
bit.
Why does cartography deserve to die?
Well, I really miswrote that. I should have said the ideal of cartography deserves to die.
No, you shouldn't. No, you absolutely should have kept
every
it.
Every interviewer
like
has raised that point. One quote is no, the idea is that before the early 19th century, very late 18th century, nobody thought about mapping or map making as a single endeavor. You know, you go to Samuel Johnson's Dictionary of 1755, the famous, the first great, thorough, comprehensive dictionary of English. He's very clear. A map is a geographical picture. A globe is a geographical model. A chart is a marine map, which is not the same thing, he says, as a geographical map, because it's only interested in the seas. It doesn't care about the interiors of continents. And a plan is something completely different. In fact, there are several terms, a survey, geodesia, a plan. Mm. All the stuff that I think is really fun and intellectually interesting and really productive for other people to know and think about how, when they're trying to deal with spatial aspects of human life, cartography says, no, none of that's interesting. Is that how you take the world and put it on paper or put it into pixels on a computer screen?
And do you think that's one of the reasons why there are also issues about racial and gender exclusion around, let's say, our field? Because I know you've spoken out about that, the way in which particularly the issue of women being involved in the field and certainly sort of racial difference, it's a problem. And is that connected to this idea of the singularity maybe of cartography? It's seen as a very Western field. Or are there other reasons for that? Because it is an issue, isn't it, within our field?
It is a very strong issue. It's much better now than it was, but it's still there are still definite issues. In the 19th century, end of the 19th century, when some German scholars, influenced by Friedrich Axel's anthropogeography, are looking at ethnographic, what they call ethnographic mapping or ethnic mapping, and they're looking at these maps made by other peoples in the ethnographic record, and they see them as being topological. That is to say, they're structured by roots and connections. They're not structured by spatial distances. Mm. And they see them as being topological, and therefore they think that these people think about space topologically and only topologically, whereas we, white, male, rational, Western scientists, we think in terms of rational space, of XY coordinates and measurements going off in all directions. And we are therefore more civilized and we are therefore better, and they are somehow less well cognitively developed. And so we have this idea that Westerners, white Caucasians, think about space rationally. When you get down to it, we think about space as topologically as anybody else all the time. Just think about how you ask for directions on the street corner. Mm. It's not go 20 feet that way and 500 feet north. It's, yeah, go down the corner, turn right. You know, it's topological. It's basic. And then women who have been in the West excluded over time from academic interest, from intellectual interest, because for purely Western patriarchal ideas, women are deemed to be incapable of thinking about reason, thinking rationally, because they're intuitive. So women are derided within Western culture, but at times it's women who are able to mediate between ethnographic context and Western mapping. So they're the ones who are employed to take non-Western mappings and try to integrate them into Western mapping. It's completely bogus, by the way, but I always have to say this to students, you know. This is what people thought right up until really the 50s, 60s, 70s. And unfortunately, some people still do think that way, but it is an absolutely bogus, racist, misogynistic way of thinking.
I'm certainly glad it's you carrying forward the history of cartography, Matthew. And I just wish you all the best with the Chicago of History for its future ongoing publications and coming to some form of culmination. And I just want to thank you for such a wonderful discussion. And thanks for joining me on What's Your Map?
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Jill Achineku, and it's a Whistledown production. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland collection and send us suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com. That's oculi-mundi.com. Why not continue your journey with me by subscribing to this podcast? That way you'll never miss an episode.